You're listening to the good.
Don't call me Paino.
The bad.
Absolute.
And the rugby.
Folded like a deck chair.
With Paino, Lord, and the Husk. I don't know what that means.
Hello everybody and a very warm welcome to you, to the good, the bad and the rugby. I'm Alex Payne, this is James.
Hi.
And this is Mike.
Hello.
How are we, fellas? What's happening? Tins, where have you been? What's the news?
There's not much going on, it's just newborn, a month old,
good.
Same old stuff, feeding, bum wiping, but yeah, otherwise, all good in the hood.
Life in the fast lane.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of what else I've been up to. I did have a great weekend, but I can't remember what I did.
I went to the Wave in Bristol just while we're on it, which was...
That's been something on my list to do.
Unbelievable. I've teed us up a day. We were very well looked after by Ollie, who was our barman for the afternoon. And as we arrived, having had a little... We did a surf in the morning and a surf in the afternoon. And as we went to the bar, Ollie said, oh, I was listening to your podcast on the way here. I said, oh, well, let's be friends. Perhaps you could tee us up with a little afternoon of activity. And there's a growing clamour, Hoff, to see you on a surfboard. Game on?
I mean, yeah, I'm definitely going to hurt myself.
Well, it's quite hard to hurt yourself on a surfboard.
Yeah, I mean, okay, well, then I'm okay. I just thought on those wave things, don't you just get thrown off and sucked out and thrown out the back?
Well, it depends.
Yeah, but is it like a wave pool or is it one of those that you slide on? Is it one that, like Hass says, that you just get spat out the back of the...
No, it's like you. It's very clever. It's like a big concrete shore, basically, with a wave machine in the middle, and you all paddle around in a circle... And one at a time, you get on the wave. It pumps out waves every 7 seconds.
Oh, okay.
And then you get on it, you ride it 10, 15 seconds, and then you paddle back around again. I tell you what, it's bloody hard work. It's very, very good fun, though. It's a really good day out when the sun's shining. Bit of surfing, cider in the sun. Thanks very much.
When I was in Australia, I had a surf lesson with a lady called Lane Beachley, who's basically was one of the best female surfers that's ever been, and she's quite famous in Australia. And literally she gave me about half an hour and she was like, there's no point. Just you're too heavy. So Hask, you'd be screwed if I'm too heavy. Yeah, you've got no flexibility. I was like, Hask, you'd be screwed.
So yeah. Can we bodyboard?
Having an unbelievable surf coach and she was basically,
right,
you're struggling.
That was short-lived. Yeah. Actually, good fun.
Tell you what I did do at the weekend, because it was sunny and windy. I thought it'd be a great idea to take sort of four children kite flying. On Minch and Hampton Common.
Oh, Minch Common, I've done a bit of that.
And so I spent 3 hours untangling string. It was the most stressful 3 hours of my life, where I just was shouting at children as they were running around and crossing strings and tying them all up. And then they'd take two other kites, and I'd spend the next hour untangling that one. And just as I got that one up, they'd have tangled the next one.
Was it one of those where you go up with four kites and you come back with none, having put four kites in the bin?
Fortunately, I took a pair of scissors, so I got a fair bit of string and then reattached. At the end of it, the kite was only about 6 feet away from their hands. But at least they couldn't tangle them anymore.
They didn't sing about that in Mary Poppins, did they?
No.
Right, to our guest this week. I'm going to be honest, he's one of the most requested we have ever had. Currently, the physical performance manager for Wales. He's been on the last three Lions tours. He'll be on his fourth this summer. He's worked with Wasps, England and Toulon, and he's known by two alter egos, Bobby Boucher and The Rope. But this is a family show. We're recording in daytime hours, so we're going to say a very warm welcome to Mr. Paul Strigeon, with a power background and a new T-shirt, fresh out of the packet, for good, bad and rugby. How are you?
New T-shirt, mate. I had no clothes clean. And when Hass ran me yesterday, I thought, pull it out the bag. Ironed it this morning myself. My mum would be proud.
You look resplendent, set against a regal red WRU emblazoned behind you. Lions probably on the wall next door, I hope. How are you? What's happening? Are you running between two different camps? What's keeping you busy?
Yeah, I'm good as well, thank you. I got back to the UK last week, so I've been doing a bit of Wales stuff, and then tomorrow we go to for a recce in Jersey. Myself, Thumper, Warren, Prav, and the coaches. So heads of department and coaches, I'm going tomorrow morning until Friday doing a recce.
Good. I cannot tell you. I've had one of those days and I'm fighting fires left, right and centre, and we start recording this and your smiley face comes on and the world just feels a better place. You have one of the most infectious personalities out there, which we're going to get into. Before we do that, I want you to kind of give us a bit of a remit for what is on your sort of job spec in the various roles that you have, because we're going to get into some of the more extraordinary things that you're asked to do, take on, and the support that you offer. But when you say, hi, I'm Paul, and I do dot, 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 what follows?
Shit, man, I can't believe I'm nervous talking to you, lads. It's mental.
I'm excited.
Initial role, but that encompasses a lot. So I've got a great team underneath me. Fitness coaches, assistant fitness coaches, sports scientists, and we've got quite a large team of interns as well who help us along. So I just manage them and just delegate to people, and that's my main job, really. And then obviously training the boys is me, the other bit that I do. So describe myself as a motivator, for one. Someone who's a link between the coaches, the medics, and the fitness staff. So that link between all the departments. So I'm in a bit of everything, really. I'm dipping in and out of everything.
A man with many fingers and many pies. How would you describe our guest this week?
I was hoping you were going to ask me that, because it's much more multi-layered. It's obviously head of performance, motivator, morale booster, medical healer, for those of you who know what I'm talking about, energy giver, the conscience of the team. I think I would describe Bobby as that. I think the conduit between the players and the coaching staff. Lots of modern coaches, I mean, you know, obviously, you know, Bobby's, you know, working with Wayne Pivac, we saw, and we all came out at the back of that show saying what a fantastic coach he was, and we all wanted to play for him. A lot of coaches aren't often like that, and you need someone like Bobby to be able to, A, deliver their message in a way the players understand, but also a bit of an agony aunt for the team to be able to go to someone like Bobby and say, listen, what's this happening? How do I do this? Or for Bobby to go, you know, if I've had a bad game, for him to pick up the pieces and go, listen, that was Saturday, this is Monday, how do we do it? Entertainer, media expert, content creator, storyteller.
You're going to get a pay rise after this.
Yeah, you should do. Also, there's a couple of other ones. Incredible smelly individual. Like, but also, I don't know what the name
smelling
for.
Smelly or
smelly? Smelling. Yeah. You smell fantastic. You know, like you get those people in who work for perfume. I don't know what the name is, perfumeries. The guys with the noses, they're called the noses. Bobby always smells brilliant, but at 500 feet can identify a perfume or an aftershave anyone's wearing and let you know exactly what it is. He's tanned 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, and always is always immaculate. So that's Paul Strigan in a nutshell.
That'll do me.
Sit back down, you're going nowhere. We should also mention Commonwealth Games wrestler. I mean, let's get into it. I mean, there are so many things to talk to you about. Should we start with Lions first of all? 2-minute conversation with Warren. He said, are you in? And you said yes, or did you have to think about it? Did you need to seek permission? How did you sign up for Tour 4?
Yeah, see, he said into it, am I up for it? As soon as he got the job, and then that was it. Like you said, 1-minute conversation, but then because of all the COVID problems, it took until last week for us to get an official offer, so we only officially came on board last week, yeah.
Good, Keith. Key man to have signed up. Tell me, I mean, we hear so much about what the Lions means to the players, but what does the Lions mean to you?
Well, it's fantastic, isn't it? It's absolutely amazing. Such an honour, such a privilege. To be able to go once is an absolute privilege, but to be able to go four times will be something special. I mean, international rugby's big, but Lions is just next level. I can't wait for it. It's going to be fantastic. And there's a lot of pressure in there. There always is a lot of pressure, but everyone knows that it's just got that special edge to it. And yeah, it's going to be fantastic.
And obviously, you know, you've done tours before and you've worked with some unbelievable characters. Are you plotting and planning on this being like a tour like no other because of the restrictions and the challenges? And what has Warren said to you about your remit out there in terms of energizer, motivator, etc.? I mean, there's a lot on your shoulders to make this as fun and as entertaining as it can be, isn't there?
Yeah, but with the COVID challenges, with the bubbles that we'll have and we're stuck in hotels, we've got to keep boredom at bay. So obviously that's a big part of our job as fitness coaches. Keep the boys happy and keep them motivated when they're not training. Obviously, we've got to train them hard.
Are you, because I know obviously a lot of time you kind of obviously very meticulously plan with your conditioning and stuff, and I know sometimes it can seem off the cuff. Are you having to think more so about this tour in terms of your role as kind of the entertainer and energy bringer? Because, for example, with England, during this period of time, a lot of the feedback came because the rules were so strict. A lot of the guys really struggled, and this is such an unknown territory. I wondered, are you pre-planning? Are you packing extra makeup, wigs? I mean, what's the story?
Yeah, we've been ordering everything, playing cards, poker table for the boys, just so they can play the whatever they play. Not gambling, but just play that. So we've been ordering everything you can think of, table tennis. In Japan, there was some, I don't know if you saw them, in Japan they had them electric dart machines where you throw the darts, and it tells you what you've scored, and it tells you what you need to get. They're about $4,000, so club with the team managers managed to sort us one on a rental. Yeah, they're hard to get in the UK, but we got one last week, and stuff like that's massively important. On a tour normally, but even more so when we're going to be going into a bubble and not being able to leave the hotel that often.
If Carl Sinclair gets invited on the tour, obviously we don't know yet. Last time we were in New Zealand, we were playing Round the World on the table tennis table, and Sinclair fell through the middle of it and just destroyed it. It was matchsticks by the end of it. So I wonder, I mean, obviously everything has to be socially distanced, so the chances of that happening, but it's good to see that you're getting all these extra equipment. Is there anything kind of unique you're going to try to do? Because one of the things that you do brilliantly with, for example, the Lions, and what you do with Wales and with Wasps and Toulon, is bringing the team together really quickly. And when I interviewed kind of Warren and when we talked about Wayne, one of the things they said was your ability to bring those players together. Because you're not going to have the luxury of kind of having everyone always together, is there anything you've sort of really thought about that you're going to do? Any sort of anything we should know about, any secret tricks that Bobby Boucher can pass on?
We've not got anything specific, and as you know, the main thing about the Lions, one of the main challenges is that we'll have guys meeting 2 weeks before we leave, so they'll have 10 days in Jersey and then go to Edinburgh for the first game, and then we'll have guys who just meet the boys when they leave. Anyone who gets in the Premiership final will just meet the boys at the airport, so that's a challenge in itself. We haven't got anything specific, and obviously a lot of time you can have a social with the boys. You might go out for a couple of social beers, but we won't be able to do that. So we'll just be in the team room. Like we said, we'll get some quizzes going. We'll have a darts tournament, a pool tournament. And just get people mixing as much as we can whilst adhering to COVID restrictions.
Just when you say that some of the lads will meet them directly on the plane. Is that going to be a problem? Do you think that's a problem? Because obviously Warren's made a bit of a statement about not giving them preparation time. Do you think that's going to be a problem going forward, or is that just the quality of the players that will be in that final? You know, they'll be able to just adjust and fit in as needs be, or do you think he will actually consider that in his selection process?
Obviously, you want as much preparation time with your players as you can. So, but obviously, I don't think that's going to happen. So we'll just deal with what we've got. We'll work the boys hard. The guys who have got 2 weeks with us, they'll be in a good place. And because we're going to be playing altitude in Joburg, we'll have some individual altitude machines. So it's an individual altitude mask. I mean, it's absolutely hanging. We had them in 2009. Then at Wales, we've got an altitude chamber so we can get 20 guys in there. But because of COVID restrictions, we couldn't get them all in the same room. So we had to get a bigger room, and they all had these masks on. And some of the guys in Six Nations were pulling off, thinking they were choking, they were drowning. So it was quite tough. So the guys who were with us for that first 2 weeks will be doing that. And then we'll take the masks with us and continue that training when we're at sea level in Cape Town. So when we go up to altitude to play, then the boys have had a decent amount of altitude work. And obviously the guys who only meet us on the plane won't have had any of that because they'll have been with the club. So we'll just have to pick them up where we can.
Has that been some of the fun that you've had with it? Not only just interacting with the players and being Bobby and wrestling people and doing everything else that you do, but some of the challenges that you faced in terms of the conditioning side, it throws back to Hong Kong when you went over there and you played the Barbarians, and obviously that heat that you had to deal with and getting the training right there, and then obviously altitude training for it, depending on where the games are in South Africa. Is that something that flicks your switches too?
Oh, yeah, I love it. I mean, before we went to Japan this year, we did a lot of heat stress work. Even if you played at sea level, you get some benefit by training in a hot environment. You get increased plasma volume, so basically you get more blood in your body to pump the oxygen around. So even if you're going to play at normal temperature, over 40 degree heat is something that's really good. So in 2015, before the World Cup in England, we took the boys to Doha, and we had a heat camp there. And it was like 45, 46 degree heat at like 8 in the morning. And the boys had some absolutely horrendous sessions there. Some real dark places. Some guys started overheating at the end of training, had to get into an ice bath for like half an hour. Not just for recovery, just to cool down. And that's something we've carried on when we had a bit of a heat camp and altitude camp in Switzerland before the last World Cup. And also we had the boys going in hot baths as well. So you get a lot of benefits that you get from training in heat by just having a hot bath, 40 degree bath up to your neck. So we had the boys sat in there for 20 minutes, which is quite uncomfortable at the beginning. But you should try and push that up to half an hour. So we get a lot of benefit from that as well. It gives something the boys something fresh to do. And then obviously you go and you try and train for the environment you're going to play in. So it's important from a physiological perspective when we're going to altitude to have done some altitude, but also for the placebo effect that the boys have actually been there mentally and they know they've done that work in altitude.
What is fascinating about that, Bobby, is that you are in charge and responsible for putting some of the best rugby players in the world into some incredibly uncomfortable places. I'm fascinated to know how they equate that with you. I mean, you're such an energizer, and yet you are the source of a lot of their misery. I mean, did you get called names under the sun that we obviously can't repeat on a family show, or do they understand needs must? How do you balance the hurt arena with what they've got to get done?
We've always tried to create an environment that allows the player to get better, so he can be as good as he wants to be physically. The boys know that if they work hard and they empty the tank and they go to that dirt place, then they're going to be better on the field. So every time we do something with the players, there's always a why. We tell them why. So we're not just doing it for the sake of it. I mean, in Switzerland, Gats did one for the sake of it because Gats loves the Henny Muller from when he was young, from when he was in the All Blacks. So Haskell remember the Henny Mullers. Tim, do you remember them, wouldn't you? Henny Muller, so you start on the corner flag, you run the in goal, and then you run the diagonal to the other in goal, and then the diagonal back. So it's like a big Union Jack. Back in the day, if training was going shit, Gats would make us do a Henny Muller. But then when we went to Switzerland, so we're at altitude, we trained on a lower pitch for the last day, about 800 metres, and it was absolutely boiling. And at the end, Gats went, "We're doing some Henny Mullers, mate. We're doing some Henny Mullers, mate." It's actually a Texan.
That's good.
Then, I think it was Beijing.
You spent that long with him, and that's as good as you get.
I'm deaf in one ear, aren't I? That's right. So Gats set him off in the positional groups. So we set him off in Henny Mullers. I think we did two with like 2 minutes rest. And about half the team were vomiting, but he's just there laughing. And we can't help but smile, can we? Because we've done the work.
I tell you what I wanted to ask you very quickly. When you were talking about stuff you're pulling together to make the tour interesting, is there anything that Warren's just popped into his rider that he's just quietly asked you to get? Is it a little foot massager or a Babyliss hairdryer, or just make sure one of those is on the tour itinerary? Or is he pretty simple in terms of what he needs in order to get through 8-9 weeks on tour?
Mate, he's dead organised, isn't he? Like, if you go in his room or on his desk, everything's like absolutely bang on to like with a ruler. So
is that right?
Oh, mate, yeah. There's nothing that won't be that he will forget. I'll probably turn up without my phone, laptop, shoes. He won't forget anything.
Bob, I've got a question. Obviously, we talked to Gats, about sort of those old school mentality, like you said, kind of balancing the understanding of putting a team together, the understanding of kind of modern science, which he's always been very keen on, because I think a lot of the listeners, you would basically be in charge of timings of sessions, wouldn't you?
We'll have a rough idea in the week, the start of the week, but every day we'll just revisit it and we'll only confirm the session in the morning before an afternoon session, because we want to see how the boys are after the morning session. So it's good. You've got to be flexible to get the best out of the boys. Just because it's written on a piece of paper that you're doing 50 minutes earlier in the week doesn't mean that you're going to do 50 minutes when you come to it. You may need more, you may need less. So, yeah, we will alter that, yeah.
Because he then said that, for example, remember at WASP back in the day, he made us do, there's 100 scrums. Do you remember where we had that 100 scrum session where Joe Worsley basically said he had an arthritic toe and couldn't do it, so I had to do it. And then Simon Shaw did 5 of them and then basically just quit. And I had to do every single one of them in the second row. He obviously said that sometimes he likes to push the team, like you said, with the Henny Mullers. As kind of a sports scientist, does that still sit with you well? Do you mind that kind of stuff? Do you sometimes have to say you're mad, or do you just... I'm interested to know from your perspective, because I've never talked about it.
What I think is you get a lot of conditioners, and I'm not saying this is a particularly bad thing, but they'll try and make training exactly of the seconds between rooks in a game. And you know yourself, one rook might be 10 seconds. We could have a 5-minute basket player, so I always think that we can't just train an exact amount of time for an amount of time within a session, as in a 3-minute phase, a 2-minute phase. And I also think that because kind of a worst case scenario, we try and train for the worst case scenario by doing 5-minute conditioning games. But I also think that from a mental aspect, that sometimes the old school stuff is good. So we wouldn't want to do Hannibal after every session, but I think sometimes, just for the boys to do it, just for the boys to be absolutely shitting themselves halfway through the session, knowing they're going to do it is good as well. Just puts them out of the comfort zone. So we'll do that in World Cup camps from time to time. And
it's funny, isn't it? Because you get some, like Dave Redding in that camp that we did in 2003, he would literally walk on the field and stop the training session. Then you get some who, like yourself, who don't mind a bit of the... But it's the balance that's the hardest thing to... I mean, you have coaches who want to do this old style. So, like, Dean Ryan used to have this thing called, right, we're going to have a blue sky session, which basically meant if you train really well, it should finish after, like, 15 minutes. But everyone knew it was never finishing after 15 minutes. It was at least going an hour. So he wants you to go flat out from the off. But you're knowing, if you go flat out from the hour and from the off and you do 15 minutes, you're not finishing. Even though it might have been the best session ever, you still do it in an hour. So then the boys are like, well, what's the point in going, let's just do it as a normal training session. Then he'll pull you in after 15 and go, lads, you're just not giving everything. I said, I'd quit it. And we're going, we know you won't quit it. But then does that ever mess with your head? From a conditioning point of view, is do you ever worry about the numbers? Because everything is so data driven now in terms of stress levels, you know, you're 1 to 5 on your heart rates and everything else like that. Or do you just, you're just there to pick up the pieces?
No. So Warren and Wayne, after Warren here, they're great with the sports science. And obviously, sports science is a massive part in rugby. But we use it as a guide for us. We don't live or die by the numbers. If the Hannibals were in there, it would have been planned at the start of the session. So okay. We would have factored that in. We try and keep a rugby session around 50 minutes because we always think that, like a bit like what you said, if you tell a player who's training for 75 minutes, he's going to pace himself because he knows that he can't go balls out for 75 minutes. Whereas if you tell him 50 minutes, he can empty the tank on every drill. So we like to keep it 50 minutes, maybe go to 55, but absolutely maximum intensity. With minimal breaks in between. So in between blocks, we call it transition time. We try and keep them below a minute. So because we've got Alan Wynn, who's like a kid who sprints to the next drill, everyone follows him. So the boys will sprint there, they'll have a 30-second drink, and then we're into the next drill. We limit coaches' talking time. And at the end of the sessions, we'll give coaches feedback on how long that transition time was, because if that's too long, obviously, it's less game-related. And I know we can have big breaks in the game, but we want to train the boys higher than game intensity, so we try and keep them respiratory.
Does Alan Wynn really still sprint from drill to drill?
Still does it. It's amazing, honestly. I call him Philo, don't I? First in, last out. He's first at training, and he's the last off, and he's not doing it for effect. He is that. And between every drill, bang, sprints there. Try and beat everyone.
Well, what a man to drive standards.
Is it true he was actually born in 1940 and they did sort of special medical science on him?
Yeah.
Tins was known as FIFO, first in, first off.
First in, first out.
Yeah.
I want to get into what makes you tick and how you've ended up where you've ended up, actually. I mean, because you went to a rugby school in Wigan, is that right? Did you go to John Fisher,
yeah, rugby league school.
But there are a lot of kids who've come through there, so that's Owen Farrell, yeah. Chris Ashton. Did Sean Edwards go there as well?
Sean Edwards, Chris Ashton, yeah.
Did you play a bit?
No, I was shit. I was like 50 kilos wet through on the wing. I was a decent tackler because of the wrestling. That was it. I was terrible.
So how on earth did you end up 50 kilos dripping wet going into wrestling?
There was a club near me called Riley's Gym. It was absolutely terrible old building. It had a lot of history. There was a lot of famous wrestlers that come from there, but there was a lot of professional wrestlers that come from there. And it was near my granddad's house, and he took me down when I was 6. I was actually, when I first went down, my first competition, I was 23 kilos. My first weight category. Because it's a weight category sport, it goes up 23, 27, 31. You can get away with it. You don't have to be 15 kilos like I have to do it, because if you're under 15 kilos, you're fighting guys under 15 kilos. I got half decent, so I was good, and then I trained there, and then we used to go train abroad a lot. We used to go to Belarus, go to Minsk in the old USSR training camp.
Whoa!
Yeah, it was horrendous. Ox tongue in the morning, and it was like the tongue had been just cut. You can see the muscle. And I'd been losing weight. Before a big competition, like European Championship 2002, I had to make 60 kilos, 9 stone 6, and lived at like 72. So it was happy days for me because I just didn't want to eat anything because the food was like, yeah. The rooms are terrible. There was no phones in there. So we had to get a taxi for an hour to go to this phone booth where you gave someone the number and then you he gave someone the number, they ring the number, and then you can use the phone. It was terrible. Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Sorry, am I talking too much, mate?
No,
that's what we're here for.
I'm fascinated by it. So what was that like for a boy from Wigan going to the USSR?
It was mental. It was cheap as well, cheap chips. This guy came in with sweet corns and he was eating them in the bar. And when I woke up in the morning, we had like a recovery day. When I woke up in the morning, all the sweet corns was inside of me. So, you know, what's happened to that.
Oh, no.
Were you a good kid? I mean, did wrestling, not sort of wrestling, but did you need wrestling to keep yourself in check? Or were you just a good kid who found something that he was very good at?
I was a decent kid because my mum and dad had good parents, like they've good morals. My mum's Catholic, so I've not always lived by the Catholic values.
Did you leave that part out then, Bob? Did you?
I am Catholic, but yeah, it was all right. I was deputy boy at school, you know.
When I tell
people that, they're like,
I think you should not tell people that because they'll judge the school very, very harshly.
Yeah.
I want to know, Bob, because obviously, I mean, we want to talk about the wrestling thing, but have you always been a larger-than-life character? Because obviously, when I first met you, how old were you when you went to Wasps?
22.
So, I was obviously younger than you, but you've always looked quite young, youthful. You've got the old lids gone, salt and pepper. That's too much fake tan, I think, too much stress. Having 17 kids, that'll turn the hair grey.
Bathing in aftershave doesn't help either.
Were you always a larger-than-life character, even in like the wrestling squads? Were you known as, like, you know, a bit crazy Bobby, or were you, you know, obviously Paul, because you were Paul back then. I don't know even who named you.
Don't even know who Paul Spridgen is, do they anymore? Who the hell is that? And we always have a bit of banter. When I left primary school, I had a bit more banter because I was a skinny little rump before that. So
yeah. You're quite scrappy because you obviously had the wrestling skills. Like, one of the reasons Alex asked you earlier when he said about, you know, you obviously put the guys through the ringer and punish them, but you're also the entertainer, and a lot of coaches struggle to straddle that line because sometimes they're seen as if you're too jokey, but yeah. You do both. Like, I've seen you going, "Right, lads, it's not fucking good enough, I'll kill you all," and then everyone laughs, but then you could wrestle, fold up any of them, which I find amazing.
Yeah, but we've got a wrestling mat here at the Vale, but as I'm getting fatter and older and weaker, people are getting closer to me, so if anyone grabs me now, I do shoot myself a bit. I just have a couple of ankles.
Are you still undefeated, though?
Yeah, I am, but the matches are less now. I don't have many matches now.
Take us through some of the scenarios where you've been challenged and folded someone up like a deck chair, as Tins would say. Who's come at you and you've thought, yeah, they could make it, but you've popped back in their box and sent them home?
Graham Rowntree, when I was in England, yeah, came back, and I just kept diving for his ankles like a Jack Russell. Do you remember that, Tins? No.
Yeah, I remember.
In 2011 World Cup camp, Dazzle Lankles, take him down. Because as soon as you get somebody's knee a bit like that, the goners. So I did that and he just kept coming back and coming back. He looked like he was going to kill me, so I just like backed off a bit.
I think we've had the story where you came in early days, must have been 08 or something, and you had to take on Barks, didn't you? And Barks like dismissed you going, "Why have you given me this skinny little runt?" And then he spent an hour with his face in sand. Literally. It was like he was the 7-stone weakling and you were just dusting him with sand every now and again. And he was like, "Who the fuck is that guy?" And I was like, "Oh yeah, Commonwealth wrestler."
Who's the hooker?
Who is the hooker? Okay, yeah, because you did a back session and then you did a forward session. So I don't know who you wrestled. It would have been Dowie Duke or it would have been Azam. It wasn't Ollie Azam, was it?
I don't think it was, but he came on and said, "Who the fuck is that? Fucking Hulk Hogan."
I love it. Tell us about the Commonwealth Games. I mean,
well, you know, no, it's not.
Yeah, you can. And we're working with Hask and Tins. It's not exactly a, you know, family show, although we try and set it out like that. Tell me about the Commonwealth Games. I mean, you know, as highlights go, was it always a dream? Did you end up thinking, how have I ended up here? You know, what was the story and the journey to get to that point? And what was the reaction and your sort of satisfaction at achieving it?
When I was wrestling, obviously wrestling is an Olympic sport. But then in Athens, I was less than 20, I was 19, so that was a bit early for me. And wrestling's similar to rugby. You peak about 27, 28. So when the Commonwealth Games came around, Manchester got it because it was a choice sport. So it's not automatically in. So that was probably a goal for me for that 2 years. And I was working with Craig White then. Craig White, who was at Wasps, who took me to Wasps with him. He was before Ireland Rugby Union and Bolton Wonders. So he was doing all my S&C stuff. So I used to go and train with him as a little rat. And then, obviously, it was a massive goal for me and to represent England at the Commonwealth Games in Manchester with all my family there. It was fantastic. It was brilliant. In the GMAX, it was full. I lost my first two matches against India and Australia, and then I beat Namibia. So It was all right. It was good. Good to get a win and not lose three.
How amazing. Were you ever tempted to sort of keep doing it and keep going with it? I mean, would we ever have seen you as not the Undertaker necessarily, but, you know, Bobby the Rope, or, you know, what would you have your nom de plume been if you'd gone into it in a big way?
The Rope, probably.
Right.
I'd love to. What would the walk on be? Just the just the rope spin.
Indiana Jones music or something.
Is it true that the rope was born out? And I'd be very careful. We can cut this out if you don't want to put it. But is it true that the rope was born out? That during a wrestling camp, obviously back in the day, things were slightly more kind of liberal. You open showers, and your coach was just leaning there, just talking to people, and you emerged from the shower 45 kilos wet through, 5 kilos of which was hanging between your legs. And the direct quote was, "Bobby, has your dad seen that?"
Yeah, that did happen. That did happen. Now, if that happened now, people would be worried, but then, has your dad seen that? And I'm like, what?
I was thinking about this yesterday when you said you were going to come on. I was thinking about the World 15 that the rope has touched would be an unbelievable team. Either slapped on the head or on the leg. Fixed. How many injuries you fixed?
It only ever hits someone who requests it. I don't just come hitting them at random. Only ever travel call me and say, "Bobby, Jonathan Davis needs on his ankle." Get everyone to look away. You shouldn't look at it. Bang. Quick one.
I'm pretty sure when I was doing bench press and you whacked me on the head with it, I did not request that.
I said these days, didn't I? That's a historical allegation, Brett.
It's like bathing in the Ganges or being hit by the rope. It's a kind of sort of, you know, a healing power that no one quite... Tell us about the early days at Wasp, because, I mean, Hask, I know, looks back on it as the greatest days in your life, Hoff?
I think so. Look, I was always lucky to be part of lots of different environments, but those early days, I think, purely because there was a revolution in terms of the health and fitness with Craig and his team. You know, the guys that came in, Alan Ryan, Mark Bitcombe, it was Craig White, Mark Bitcombe, or Big Guns, and Bobby, and they were the kind of the spine who came in, and they created such a professional attitude and mindset off the field, but also with that balance being like, listen, we're going to work you really hard, but we want you to really enjoy it. And Bobby, you know, with the invention of the Bobby Cup every week, and for those who don't know what the Bobby Cup was, it was Bobby's alternative man of the match. So, for example, you'd have, you know, Tom Rees wins it, Stuart Barnes gives it to Tom Rees on the weekend, and then you would have Ali McKenzie, a former Wasp days, winning it. And, you know, but Bobby wouldn't do it just a man of the match. There would be dressing up involved. There was the Wasp mascot, Sting.
Question of sport,
yeah. Where Aola Rinley was on Question of Sport and he won a teapot 2 weeks in a row on the official show, and we reenacted that. We did Sting. Well, but I say we did. Bobby did Sting on a big day out where he dressed as a mascot and went out on London and then got a girlfriend at the time. A fake Sting girlfriend. And they announced man of the match. And just every week, you know, win or lose, Bobby would bring that kind of level of entertainment.
Only
when we won, yeah, sorry.
No, we won 17 in a row, so I was running out of ideas.
From your perspective, Bobby, what were those days like? As a young kid, obviously huge potential and success in wrestling, but Craig White said, "Great, come and join us." You ended up with Gats, and Sean Edwards must have been a sort of hero of yours as a Wiganer.
You know, it's a funny story, because Sean was a hero, man, like you said. He'd won a million trophies in the league. So when I went to Wasp, they said to me on the first day, "Listen, you're going to be living with Sean." So imagine me, I'm like, what the hell? So first day I'm there, stay over. Me and Craig lived in bunk beds at Sean's house. He had a double at the bottom, I had a single at the top. So first morning, like, Sean's my idol. And then next thing, he's like, "Do me a favour, kid, make us a cup of tea." So I take him a cup of tea to him. And then he takes it in bath, and he comes out of the bath with his robe on, cup of tea still in bag. He said, get your clothes on, mate. We're going carnival." It was Notting Hill Carnival. I joined in August in 2002. So we get there. I didn't even know what Notting Hill Carnival was. I'm from Wigan, mate. We have King Street in Wigan, and that's it. With about 2,000 people on. At the end of the night, I'm like, I went to Sean and went, "Mate, it's brilliant, this London." I'm like, "Is it like this every week?" "Don't, mate, it's just once a year. It's once bank holiday weekend." It's brilliant, mate.
I love Bobby. I love you made you get the cup of tea as well. Like, Sean was definitely loves a bit of hierarchy, doesn't he? Like, "Hey, kid, get that." Do you remember that time you walked past the gym and rescued me when he made me hold a Swiss ball by the side of my head while he was punching it?
Yeah, punching it.
And every now and then punching me and pretending he wasn't doing it, but he knew exactly what he was doing.
He was just trying to put a bit of fear in him, innit?
He put a lot of fear in me when he used to go off and weigh in naked in front of me while I'm... He'd go away, get on the scales, be like, go away, come back with pants, and then be like, nah, and then be fully naked with boxing gloves and a giant cup of tea with seven tea bags, all the while I'm standing there holding a Swiss ball next to my head. But I can see Bobby's like that, like looking, going, Hass, mate, you've got academy weights in a minute. And I'm like, yeah, I just not want to make eye contact with anyone.
Did you, I mean, obviously it was successful, but did you have quite a lot of fun as a coaching group as well? It looked it.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's brilliant because we're all good mates. Like, three of us are living together in West London. We used to go down to Richmond or go to Notting Hill to walk around. I mean, me and Sean used to go and drive around, get his old Mercedes, his old blue one he had, and drive about one dash, drive around London at nights and just drive around with the Oasis on singing. Just going around sites and show me the sites. It was brilliant. We used to go to a place called Bedbar, and we had some great fun. And obviously, we managed to win a trophy or two every year, so it meant that we had some great times and some great celebrations after.
Talk to me about Lawrence as well, who was the sort of the totem pole at the club at the time. Is it true he used to have a whip round for you to boost your wages? Or have I made that up?
Sometimes they did. I think they did a couple of times.
But obviously, you know, Lawrence was an icon in Union, and peas from quite different pods, I'd imagine, you and he. But when you said to him, right, that's it, you're doing a Henny Muller, did he go, yes, Bobby, of course? Or was he like, actually, the old calf, you know, I'll give you a warm-up all the game, but I don't need to give you both?
No, the law was great. When he led by example on the field. He led the team tremendously with how he spoke. He was an amazing motivator, especially when it came to the business end of the season where he got paid more. Me and Sean said, we're going to try and not cry today, because he'd always pick on something or someone, and we'd be in tears before the game, and I was only running water. You know what I mean? Imagine the rest of the lads. But he would lead by example in what he said, but he would also lead by example in training. I mean, he would work hard. He wasn't a shirker.
How did you always approach someone like Shawsey, the Mr. Sappuccino, who literally was dying on a Sunday, even worse on a Monday, but then miraculously he would recover by a Friday? Yeah. With players like that who just turn out and do the job every week, do you just let them manage themselves?
It's all about, I mean, people can be obsessed with training, but it's all about what happens on the weekend, isn't it? And that's what I say that to some lads. As long as it's all right on Saturday, we're ready to go, aren't we? But obviously, if someone doesn't train hard enough for a long period of time, someone who needs to, they're not going to do well. But you might look after someone in a certain week, or if someone is Shaw's age, he was still playing when he was 50, then you need to look after him and you get the best out of him. And I think the fact that Shaw's liked coming in the club and didn't want to do too many jobs around the house and trained on every day off that he ever had, I think that prolonged his career as well.
And England camp started 3 days before it did for him as well, which is the best bit. In his calendar, it'd be like, we were supposed to meet up on a Sunday. Shawsey would disappear on a Friday just to go to extra training. And he found out he'd be in Ricky Flutie's living room. But like, Shawsey, where are you not supposed to be on tour? And he's gone. Bobby, I want to know, obviously, you live with Sean, which I imagine was an eye-opening experience. But there was another character from the Wasp days that, because you were kind of, when you first came on, is it fair to say you were sort of the apprentice fitness guy, weren't you, with Whitey? You were sort of the...
I came for no money. I'm just on as an intern, I got a work experience for a month, and then that's managed to get me $8,000 a year. That was my first work, $8,000 a year. But they paid me rent at Sean's house. Obviously, that went up after a bit, after I got the Academy Fitness role the year after that.
But obviously, but you also then had to do some pretty, you know, weird jobs, like living with Trevor Liotta. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that time that you met? Because that's above the call of duty, that, really.
Yeah, so I was living in Richmond with my girlfriend at the time, and Trevor's family had gone back to New Zealand. And obviously, we had the Heineken Cup final against Toulouse. It was Toulouse and Bath, wasn't it? We had Heineken Cup final, and then I think we had Bath in the final the following week. Warren was obviously worried about Trevor and his weight, and he lived with one of his mates, so he was worried about him going out, drinking a bit, and not being ready to go. So Warren said to me, I've got a job for you. I said, Trevor's going to move in with you for 2 weeks. And he said, I'm going to give you some money. I'll pay you a certain amount a day to be his minder. So I cooked all Trevor's meals. We used to go to train together, come home. But he'd always try and pull a fast one. He'd always say, I've just got to nip home for something. And then he'd just disappear. Once I went back to his house, and I rang his mate and he said, where is he? He's going, he's not here. And when I looked through the window, they both sat there watching TV. I'm like, Trev, you need to come home, mate. obviously he enjoyed it, but he just wanted a bit of his own freedom. Anyway, there's the RPA Awards on a Tuesday night, and Gat said to me, right, Trevor's going, you're on Steve Hayes' table, there's 200 quid, go and buy yourself a black tie suit. So I get a black tie suit, turn up at Grosvenor. Trevor had only got wind that I was going, and he didn't turn up.
I love that.
Unbelievable.
In the end, I couldn't find him. One night, I couldn't find him, and I rang Gats, and I was proper at the end of my tether, and I went, Gats, it's too much. I can't do it anymore. And he went, I'm paying you. Just fucking find him.
Because he used to love the Redback, didn't he? Was he doing triangles between his house, the Redback, and KFC? I mean, because the diet was the biggest issue. Yeah. Did you ever catch him? Because remember, that we did that. I think you did a Bobby Cup when you did a tour of the changing rooms, and obviously under on Mark Denny's peg, there was a load of toothbrushes and Listerine. We can't say what was on Lowell's peg. We then went to someone else's, Garth Chamberlain's thing, and there was a load of gimp masks. Then we went to Trevor's. And it was just covered in KFC packets and stuff. That was what real life was like, though, wasn't it?
Trevor was brilliant, wasn't he? I mean, Trevor was under 123 kilos. He was brilliant, wasn't he?
He was the best hooker in the world, I think.
That was the thing for him, under 123, and he was in good shape. But Trevor trained really hard. Every time he came to the gym, Trevor was so strong, he didn't do weights. He just did power endurance, so 10 seconds of one thing, squats or cleans or wrestling, get up off the floor. That was just his session. Fair play to him, he just used to come in and eat it up, but the key for him was if he was under 123 kilos, he was good to go, but if he got much over that, then it was a struggle.
It does sound so like rugby's version of the Crazy Gang, really, but with a lot more success in there as well. Tell me about how you went from Wasps to England, and was that quite a seismic shift in, I can't imagine there were too many Bobby Cups with England, or did you take everything that Wasps was for you and put it into that international setup?
In between Wasps and England, I went to Warrington Rugby League for 8 months.
Oh, did you?
Warrington, yeah. I moved up north to be close to my family, and then when Jono came on board, Calvin Morris, who was the head of conditioning then, got me in. It was first international job. We didn't do the Bobby Cup at England, but we do it at Wales. We do it at the Lions. Yeah, when we win two games, we do it at Wales, so I still do it. I didn't have any idea about how big international rugby was. I just didn't have any idea. Been in hotels in my life, but then turn up at Penny Hill, you're like, wow, look at the state of this, do you know what I mean? You have a hot tub in your room in some rooms, do you know what I mean? In Wigan, you're lucky if you get a kettle in your room. just the sheer size of it, the sheer number of people who worked at the RFU, sheer number of coaches. I mean, we had quite a lot of meetings back in them days. But the amount of resource that goes into the national team, that's what surprised me when I got to England.
Was that why you didn't take the Bobby Cup and stuff like that? Was it because it was your first international gig and you took it not more seriously, because obviously you take your job seriously enough, but in terms of finding your feet before you sort of go stampeding in there like a bull in a china shop?
Yeah, of course it was. Yeah. You get home credibility before. The coaches had never seen the Bobby Cup, so it wouldn't be something they'd want to push. But here at Wales, the coaches have seen it and they know that it does more positive than anything negative it does, if there is anything negative about it.
Bobby, obviously, you remember they built that dojo for you, the Bobby Boucher dojo. Obviously, having done a little bit of wrestling now, the sport that you love, that I've done a bit of, was very different to what the coaches tried to make that dojo. was that frustrating? Because obviously you knew exactly what you're doing. You thought, oh, we do a bit of wrestling, it's great for conditioning. And suddenly we're in tackle suits and everyone's piling into each other. We're basically just playing rugby on mats and then trying to strangle each other.
Hey, well, Lee, I kept getting fucking Manu. I just kept getting Manu, and then he'd fill me in because he's 115 kilos and an absolute power freak. And then as I'm walking back, his family would be there or something. They'd be going, oh, I heard Manu smashed you today. I was like, I'm supposed to be building confidence, all right?
We thought it was important to get a decent amount of contact conditioning in. That doesn't always have to be full bosh, so it was a way of getting some contact conditioning in, so contact fitness. Running around and training is one thing, but rugby's a massive game of contact, as we all know. And also, it was a good way, for an injury prevention perspective, getting some contact in before we went into full contact. But the trade-off was that we had to do some of the rugby drills, so that was the trade-off. But them diving over drills, we call it platting. The boys got really good at the end of that, do you remember?
Yeah.
And that's especially Danny Kerr and the boys, I remember, were whipping over. They were like, they looked like gymnasts. And that getting up off the floor, getting up quickly, diving, jumping, getting up again. It was like rugby, innit? So it was all right. Yeah.
What's the hardest part of that camp dealing with Matt Stevens? Obviously, when Matt Stevens had gone away for his little time away and become a jiu-jitsu blue belt, I think, and had won a couple of tournaments. And then we had King of the Ring for the thing. But obviously he kept losing and kept shouting at you as the referee, saying that it was like, it's not bad, my friend, hey? It's not great.
Measy every day. Can we do some on the mats? I'm like, Measy, midnight, can we go there?
Did you learn a lot about yourself with that England experience, though, in terms of how you function best and therefore what you need in order to be able to do the job that you want to do?
I think it made me my management skills a lot better, because when you're in a club and it's day in, day out, one week rolls into the next, you just keep going and keep going and keep going. Whereas when you're in international, there's a lot more planning goes into it. When the boys come in, got to be absolutely bang on. Whereas in a club, because the boys, they're doing what they do every week, there's not as much planning would go into that. So I think my planning skills had to improve when I got to England, because you only have a certain amount of time with the boys. Every minute counts, every second counts, because the boys come in on Monday morning and then they've got a game less than two weeks after. You've not only got to get all the physical stuff in, but you've got to make sure all the rugby stuff's in as well. So yeah, I think I got better at that, which has carried me on to other roles since that.
And in terms of careers, not necessarily a roller coaster, wherever you've gone there's been success, but how did you then end up in Toulon? I imagine the sun was one very appealing factor, but if Wasps was the crazy gang, what was Toulon?
The mental gang. Yeah, it was crackers.
But did French sort of style of rugby, and how, you know, Bolsch always said to me, you have to get used to being unprofessional to play in France. Did that sort of suit your personality even better with the boys, or did it make it harder? Or
I used to struggle with it, but when you go to France, Haskell, no, if you go with thinking that what everything you've had in your club in the UK or in the international camps will be amazing, but when you're dealing with a lot of top level players like were at Toulon at the end of their careers, or you're dealing with some French guys who it wasn't as professional, the setup wasn't as professional. But if you go in trying to do what you've done before, then you'll just lose your head in no time, and then if you get onto everyone will just think you're an idiot and you'll be out the door. So you just got to drop your standards slightly. When I got there, you did have to do that a bit. But you're dealing with amazing world-class players. I mean, Neil Jenkins came kicking with Harpers before the Anakin Cup final. This just epitomises what it was like at Toulon. So we had a session on the Tuesday. Day off was on the Wednesday. And the session was absolutely terrible. Honestly, there must have been 20 balls down. Couldn't hit a line out. Terrible. So Bernd Laporte's gone, right, that's it. We come back tomorrow. And he's done one, Bernie. And the boy's like, we're not coming back tomorrow, Carl Evans. We're not coming back tomorrow. We'll do 20 minutes more now, and then we'll be done. So when they come off the field, Ali Williams, who was particularly bad in that session, Neil Jenkins said to him, bloody hell, Ali, you're not worrying for the weekend, because that was a shit session. And Ali went, don't worry about the weekend. We'll turn up on the weekend. We'll be fine. That'll have no bearing on what happens the weekend. Ali Williams got man of the match in the end. That would have been Clermont. And that just showed you that we had so many players who, in the week, could just be so relaxed, as you two lads were. And when the time comes, you just switch it on, and that's the mark of a great player, isn't it? He doesn't always have to be bang on in the week, but on the weekend, when you can whistle blow, so he goes over the line, he's ready to go.
Did you get into all things France? Did you drink a lot of red wine and a bit of foie gras, or did you miss your pot noodles and your home comforts?
Both. So Chesa's down there, isn't it? Chesa and Shaw's is still down there. So Chesa was doing his wine tasting, his sommelier's course. So I used to go round every week with Chesa, because as a sommelier, you have the smells of everything, and you have to know the smells of all what's in the wine. So he had rotten eggs, and he bought them all in test tubes, and I used to go round and test him. So I could be like 150 smells from charcoal, rubber, rotten eggs. They don't have a number on, and I'd give him a test every week. He'd smell it and have to guess what it was. And then we'd have a couple of bottles of wine, obviously. So I've done the foie gras, but every time somebody comes over from Wigan to see us, they've got to bring pot noodles and pies every time.
Love it. Absolutely amazing.
Did you do Le Bobby Coop?
Too hard, wasn't it? Too hard in French.
Well, because most of the team was English speaking, though, so I wondered if you'd snuck it in a little bit.
No, we didn't do any because you have to translate it. Everything that was said, Tom Whitford would translate for the other guys, so if you give a gag and somebody else translates it...
Have you got into Sean about his French? I mean, he's done a pretty good job, to be fair. He can never sound French with his full blown northern accent. But have you had a word with him? Because he does interviews in French, doesn't he?
It's good, mate. It's good, to be fair. I mean, I only speak French with a Wigan accent, because I always think if you go like bonjour, you sound like hello, hello, like, you're right, Dick. So, Sean, for the last year and a half when I was at Wales, he used to knock on my door on a day off, Bobby, can I have a French lesson? And then I'd just be sat on my bed. he'd be on surf and we'd give him a French lesson. I'd just test him on stuff, and anytime he got in his car, there was French tapes in there. So he'd been working on it for some while, yeah, before he got there. So he's done well.
I mean, obviously, I know you're a humble guy. So this might be a bit of a tricky question. When you went to Toulon, are you always surprised by the kind of top-level internationals who know who you are?
I don't know if I've ever thought about it.
Because everyone always... I wonder, and I was going to ask Sandy about the Lions tour, whether you feel like there's a bit of pressure, because you know, as players, we're awful gossips. Everyone talks about everything. Good bloke is a good bloke across the world. And I've been with people going... Do you know that Bobby Boucher? Like, what's Bobby like? What's Bobby like? And everybody hears about it. And I wondered what it's like for you. You know, you said Sean Edwards is your hero. You walk in and Arlie Williams is like, all right, mate. You're like, you know, I just wondered what, I wonder if you're surprised by it. Do you enjoy it? Do you feel pressure
to perform? It's nice, isn't it, when you turn up and then and people connect with you, because if they've heard about you, be it good or bad, they'll connect with you. And can I tell a story about Ali Williams? So when Wayne got the job, he coached Ali in New Zealand. So he came to the Vale and I had like 1 year left on my contract. That was before he came in. So when Wayne came in to start my contract, and I either had a new one or I was gone. So he said, can I meet you in the Vale bar? So we met him in the bar and he went, sat me down and he went, unfortunately, I spoke to Ali Williams. I know him from back in the day. He said, oh, shit. And he went, your banter's a bit close to the bone. You swear a hell of a lot around the team room and the camp and like a glass of red wine from time to time. He said, so... I'm afraid, and I was going, oh, shit. I'm thinking I'm going back, wigging here, mate. Anyway, I'm afraid I'm going off you more 4 more years.
He told a very similar story, actually. I mean, funny enough, one of the things that Wayne did say when we spoke to him a month or so ago was that signing you up was one of the first things he made sure he'd done, and he had you under lock and key. I mean, sort of reiterating Hask's questions, really, but are you conscious of the value that you bring and have to bring and your importance? I mean, you've had so much. How many trophies have you won? Do you know?
12, I think.
And counting. But, I mean, there's so much fun around you. There's so much energy. But are you very conscious of the job that you do and the impact that you have?
Yeah, I sort of know it as it's a responsibility. I feel it's a responsibility that I have to the group. We try and create that culture where the boys know they're going to work hard. It's going to be organised. I'll be the link between everyone. But we know they know that they're going to have a laugh at the right time. That can be during a session, during a warm-up, at the end of it. Then the session in the evening, whatever. At the right time, when we switch on, it's going to be hard work. But I do know that, and I do actually, for all I come across, like happy-go-lucky, just random as shit, I do actually worry about it. So, like, the night before we go in camp, every single time, be it November, Six Nations, summer, I always think, I can't do this, I can't do it, I can't do it. And it's like, honestly, it's like the first day of school every time we come back, because we know what we're going to have to deliver, we know what we're going to have to do, where we're going to, what we're going to have to take the boys to some dark places. We're going to have to get the boys to a point that they can play international rugby from playing at probably a lesser intensity for the last few weeks. So I do actually worry about it, although I look like I don't give a shit. And I go to Bennett. I said to Hugh Bennett, my assistant, I'm like, I'm sketching. I understand what I need to bring, and it is planned in my head.
Amazing.
How have you found Pivac? Because obviously I didn't know anything about him, and then obviously we had him on the show, and both myself and Hask were sort of blown away by how well he spoke, and you got a sense of the environment he wanted to try and create, and the no nonsense, and we didn't expect that. I thought he was really stiff laced, and it just didn't seem to be that. So how have you found that the Wayne Pivac experiences?
He's been fantastic. I mean, predecessor Warren was creating an environment here. We worked hard. Family came first, no micromanagement, and Wayne just came in and he's exactly the same. They're both like a glass of wine. He's good with people, he's very personable, so he knows about everyone, the families. When he speaks to you, he's asking about how you are, actually. He wants to know how you are. He comes in the morning, we'll have a quick meeting about training, and then he just lets us get on with it. And he's tremendously loyal, and he's backed us to the hilt on anything we've wanted. He doesn't mind being challenged, so it's just a great environment. And when you in any job, when you're just allowed to get on with your job and you're not micromanaged, you've not got someone breathing down your neck, it's fantastic. And it's great around the staff, and we have some good fun. I mean, we've had a lot of COVID restrictions, so we've not had too much social time, but from time to time we'll have a drink together as the staff when COVID allows, and brilliant.
You talked about you know, you taking the job seriously and being kind of sometimes nervous before camp, and one thing as a player, you never really reflect outside of your own world, and you never think, someone like yourself, you've obviously got a job to do and you're always an entertainer, but you can't afford to have a bad day. So as a player, if I have a bad day, you catch me moping, you're like, Hass, mate, what's wrong? And I'm like, fucking Bobby this, I can't, you know, I can't be doing that. But you always have to be on. How do you find that, especially on a Lions tour, especially going in it when you know the pressure is to deliver? Do you, after camp, have a meltdown? Do you have people that you phone up to? Do you, because I know you're very friendly with the other coaching staff, so sort of do you get into someone's room going, fucking hell, so-and-so's been moaning, or shut up, and they're like, Bobby, calm down, and then you go again. How do you deal with it?
I'm 100 miles an hour, I'm in my room, having a kip.
7 seconds sleep.
Remember, 7 seconds sleep. All the time. I have to train in the afternoon. I'll have half an hour's nap if I can. I don't generally get that, but if I'm in my room, I'm relaxing. I will have sounding boards that I'll have a moan to, yeah. So outwardly, I've got the mask on where I'm happy, but in my room, I might want to smash someone's face in, do you know what I mean? I might punch the wall or kick in the wall or going moaning to someone, Sean or Wayne or Gats or Benny, whoever. Yeah, so I do have an outlet. I do have an outlet, but no one will see that.
Is there any players that you've ever, because I've seen you, players who've like sort of haven't towed the party line, haven't trained hard, always making excuses. Brian O'Driscoll says a great quote about you. So the first thing I say about Bobby is that I've never met anyone who dislikes him. You feel he genuinely cares about you. That too is pretty rare. He's a bit mad, but the madness is part of what you love. He'd be the first pick on the coaching staff for any Lions tour, which from probably one of the greatest players has ever been, is incredible. Without naming them, are there some players, when you spot them, you just think, give yourself a Chinese burn in another room, or like stick your leg like with a pen to stop going? Because there's always a team. There's always some people who don't quite do what they're supposed to do.
That's the same in it, same in life. You always have a different relationship with everyone. So, for instance, me and you would have a bit of banter as well as we're working. Tinge would give me the eyebrow. Do you remember when we were going to do some more conditioning? Give me that one from back at the so. That's a different relationship with yourself. I just think some guys you don't always have no joke around with, but you get them, you try and motivate them to do the work by how you motivate them best, which you might be talking them through the session, give them a nudge up. And some lads like being shouted at. Other lads like Matt Gitto used to go to me. He was on a watt bike for 30 seconds. And I never knew this at the beginning. He was on a watt bike for 30 seconds. I've gone 10 gone. Anyway, he just all of a sudden went, don't give me fucking 10. What he was meaning was, don't start telling me there's 10 seconds gone when you're ready to go.
Yeah.
Don't tell me when we're on the downhill. Tell me at halfway. So that happened once, and I was like, okay. I'll never do that again. So it's probably a scientific thing to it, but I think it's just instinct a lot with good coaches, isn't it? That you just know how to treat different people and how to get the best out of them.
Paragliding. I cannot actually believe I'm asking this question. Paragliding into training? Question mark.
Yeah, so it was World Cup training camp 2019. We're living at 1,800 metres, 2,300 metres, whatever it was, up in Fiesch in Switzerland. And we used to get a cable car down every morning to training. So we'd train about 700 metres. So we'd live high and train low. So you get the benefits of living high at altitude. But if you train high at altitude, you lose intensity. So you go back down to train, more towards sea level. So you get the benefits of living and then training hard, and then go back up after the session. So we said, we had the last day, the boys needed to pick me up. So we said, we made a big thing. So me and Hugh Bennett, we went the day before. And there was these paragliding guys, but you could go on the back of someone. So we went, we organised it all, and we made a big thing the night before. Boys, if you missed the 8:15 cable car, you didn't make it to training. So we made a big thing the night before. Nobody miss it. It's about standards. Nobody missed that one, because you missed the last session, the most important session of the week. When the boys were going down, me and Hugh Bennett hit, and we'd already organised these guys. This showed how good the group was, really. Because what we did is we ran towards the thing as it went away. As the cable car left, me and Bennett ran as if we'd missed it. The last one, the boys were like, they've missed it. And not one of them gave us any shit on WhatsApp. I thought we'd been getting loads of texts. We didn't get one text. I think they just felt sorry for us. The boys went down to training, they walked it from the bottom, and then John Ashby and Ryan Chambers were getting the boys ready, and they used to have a speaker on. So me and Hugh Bennett are now in the air, and we're coming down. It took about 10 minutes, so Warren Thumper and the boys, and again the boys ready, they're all getting ready to stretch. And then they put James Bond music on. Dun, 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 dun. So then we come in, and then we land on the pitch. We had our whistles, and you can hear the whistles. All you see is those two coming down. But what's funny is that the bloke was like, he started doing all these side things, these side diving, me and Hugh Bennett, like, stop it, stop it, stop it. It was the most frightening thing I've ever done in my life. I was frightened.
More Money Penny than James Bond.
Alan Wynn said to Benny when he ran Galway, he went, I needed that this morning, I needed it.
Let's finish with the Lions, really. I mean, you've touched already on your love for the Lions and your excitement about going. Warren and you have a sort of a phenomenal relationship. How much work has been done already, and where are you with the sort of let's get ready to rumble?
We're probably behind where we've been before. We were behind where we've been before probably a month ago because of no one was officially appointed. We have been doing work behind the scenes. Excuse me. Obviously, we haven't been on a recce like we normally would. We normally have been on a couple of recces by now, and Thumper would have been on six. We've planned a lot of the training already. So the schedule's all done. The schedule's in place. We know what we're going to be. We know what we're going to deliver to the boys. And we know when the boys come in, what we're going to deliver, what they need to expect. So we know how we're going to train them. We know we're going to get the altitude in the first couple of weeks and then keep that going. In South Africa, we know we're going to be pushing intensity. We know we're going to be doing quite a lot of contact conditioning because obviously there's going to be a lot of contacts in the game against South Africa, and we've got to be ready for that. A lot of kick chase. We'll be doing a lot of kick chase. We've worked out how we're going to play it and how we're going to drive the culture, hard working culture, get everyone gelling in that first week. And we're going to start that with Jersey, although we won't have all the boys there. That'll be us laying down the mark, and we'll have a tough week. That first week in Jersey will be a tough week for the boys.
Are you confident when you say you're behind the curve? You've got enough time to get done what you need to get done?
We're behind the curve on stuff like ordering things for the gym and stuff like that. So we've just got to... We'll have a good week this week, and we're back on track. I mean, we're probably further behind the curve a month ago, but now we're nearly where we need to be. And then we've got this recce with heads of departments and coaches. Once this is done this weekend, we're going Wednesday... back Friday. Once we're back Friday, we'll be where we should be in relation to previous tours, and we'll be.
In your mind, Bobby, is this going to be the most challenging Lions tour that you've ever been on in terms of the disorganisation that you're having to face and the lack of real clarity on training venues, you know, where you're guaranteed, where you're playing, the structure once you're out there, is this definitely going to be that most challenging tour for you?
I think it's going to make it, it's made it very difficult till now, not knowing where we are, and obviously the bubbles will make it challenging. We can turn that into a positive because in the previous tour, I think we did 12 hotels in the first 15 days. When we went to New Zealand, we were moving around all the time, and then after every Tuesday game we moved, Saturday game we moved. So in New Zealand, I think it was only in the second test before we all had a day off, where we didn't travel. So not only are we playing the All Blacks and we're getting smashed up in the midweek games because they've got such great opposition. On our days off, we were always travelling, so we never had a rest day. So that made that quite a challenging tour. So although we'll have all these COVID restrictions, we won't be able to do a lot, and we're not sure what happens. Once it does transpire where we'll be playing, it's more likely that we'll just be in two bases, Joburg and Cape Town. What it will mean is on a Wednesday of a test week or a Wednesday of a game week, we'll be able to have a full day off, a full recovery day with no travel, because that's what really hurt us in that 2017 tour.
We've heard from Ellis how hard it was for players in with all the restrictions in the Six Nations and everything. Is that going to be coming down to you really as a crucial role of making sure that social side is still there to the level you can get it to? Do you think that's going to be probably one of the most key things going forward in that? We all know that Alliance is a social event for the players as well. And if you want to get four nations playing together as one, that side has to be ticked off. Have you got a good plan for how you're going to manage that with all the restrictions that you might have?
Yeah, I mean, that's the biggest challenge, isn't it? Four countries coming together, got to get them playing, got to get them on the same hymn sheet within a week, some of them within a week. So spend as much time as we can together. Previously on tours, we've always had double rooms, so you've always shared a room, but due to COVID restrictions, that won't be possible, so that'll make it a bit more of a challenge. We'll encourage players not just to be going sit in the room all the time, so we'll make sure that they're in the team room for a good bunch of the time. As I said, we've got the electronic darts board, the same ones as Japan. We'll have them at the class. They're absolutely class. The 4 grand, but they're brilliant. as I said, we bought loads of packs of cards. We'll have some computer games and stuff. We'll have PlayStations. In Six Nations, we had a quiz. We had that quiz, social distance quiz. We had a food challenge. It was brilliant because we had the players came out. One from each team was nominated, and they had to eat three crackers, the old school one, without a drink. So players did it. Winner got 10 points, 9, 8, 7, all the way down to one. We had 10 teams. So the staff came up then thinking, shit, I'm going to be eating crackers. This shows us what we are. Our nutritionist, Chris, fair play to him, he'd been to McDonald's. So there was all crackers on the table. So the staff thought they were eating that. So there was like 8 staff members there. And then they went, right, we're going in 10 seconds. Move the crackers and put the Big Mac there. We're having a Big Mac race, social distance, may I add. They had to eat whoever ate to the fastest one. We had Luke Broadley, our media manager, who liked a bit of food. So I think, obviously, we won't be able to have the socials like going out. So we'll have a big focus on that. And as you know, we'll have committees like we always do on any tour. So there'll be an entertainments committee, which there'll probably be 7 or 8, 7 players on there and 1 member of staff. So they'll have a big task on their hands to keep everyone.
Who's been the best member of an entertainment committee on a Lions tour from the tours you've been on?
Lee Mears was really good. Do you remember Lee Mears was really good, was that? Lee Mears. Yeah, he was brilliant. He was brilliant. Because he loved it, didn't he? He loved organising. Yeah. We went races every week. Brains on a Tuesday, races on a Friday, night race on a Friday.
Bobby, you're a ledge, an absolute ledge. I want to ask Cask and Tins, just sort of finally, I mean, the affection for this man is absolutely across the game, and it's been really nice to, you know, from the sort of back room to bring you front and centre. But Hask, from your career, the impact of Bobby and the memories that he's generated for you on your journey?
He's so influential for so many years because, you know, he was my academy kind of fitness guy for a long time. He would always go above and beyond for me. You know, I'm one of these players that sometimes had to do things for mentality. He knew that I wanted to work hard and would help me and be honest and really push me and with that level of professionalism. And I think sometimes if you have a larger-than-life character, people find it difficult to comprehend how you can be super professional, really effective at your job, but also be the life and soul of the party. And he did that so well for me throughout my career. And the general affection for Bobby is unparalleled. You go to any club and speak to anybody, and they know about Bobby Boucher, they know about Paul Strizzin, you know, for all the right reasons and for lots of funny reasons. And I think it's a credit to him that, you know, Brian O'Driscoll, Warren Gatland, Wayne Pivac, Martin Johnson, you know, Bernard Laporte, all these people rush to get him on board because they know the importance. And I think for a lot of head coaches, you have to assume a role sometimes and you can't be seen to be poacher, gamekeeper, gamekeeper, poacher. And for Bobby does that really nicely. And it's great to see in a modern world where we're all in a bit of cancel culture, we're all a bit nervous and panicked, that you can still have a man that can deliver on both sides of the coin. So I love Bobby. He's always made me laugh and helped me be a better player. And I never forget the time that they locked me in the gym to get bigger, and I came out 112 kgs or something, and Bobby was like, "Mate, Gats needs you to play this weekend." And him trying to do this like extra conditioning with me, and me going, "But Bobby, I can't breathe." And him going, "You'll be fine." But I could see the lies behind his eyes. But he made me realise I did. I had a good game. For all of 20 minutes.
You've done 6 weeks no running, haven't you?
Yeah, six weeks no running. I went from something like 108 kgs, 115 or whatever I was, or even more than that. Never run, and he convinced me. And actually, I think that's, you know, I played well. That it sort of saved me. So I've got only love for this man.
Yeah, no, look, I know. Obviously, I didn't spend as much time with Bobby, but he sort of came into England at that time where what you need is, and what people don't sometimes realise, is rugby is a job, and sometimes it can become a bit of a drag if you're not, you know, Bobby's alluded to the fact of winning and how important winning is. It makes things a lot easier. But then when you're losing, it can be dark. Training can be miserable if you're going double contact day. And sometimes you need people to lift that energy at the start. And that's what Bobby brings. And that's what's unique to him is, you know, the reason why we say there's a Sappuccino club. There is dark humour within rugby, and sometimes you need someone to lift you out of that and in the right time, whether it might be a magical touch from the rope or whatever it might be. It takes you to a place where you're smiling and you're laughing just as you're about to go to work, and that completely changes your outlook on what work is and lifts the training. And, you know, but at the same time, driving standards. And that's why he's so successful, is because he can be taking the piss 1 minute, but at the same time, if he flicks it and starts going mad at you and swearing at you, you know you've crossed a line or you haven't hit a standard. So as long as you keep him on the laughing and joking side, you know that you're doing your job. And I think that's a great thing to have. It's a great barometer for players. Players are very simple. When they get shouted at, if there's no jokes coming, they know they need to bring the jokes back because it's a lot better lifestyle. So then you just get working harder. And that's the balance that he brings, as well as being the best smelling bloke that's ever lived on the planet. And I can't believe that someone like Dior hasn't snapped him up to make his own scent yet. Yeah, I just love walking around sniffing him. So it was, I think he's been outstanding, as his CV would suggest, and long may it continue, and hopefully he'll bring back another Lions series.
So all of us. Are you available for aftershave deals, Bobby? Has anyone snapped that up? Is there a Wigan niche that we can get you sorted
and
out?
What is the fragrance of choice right now?
True.
Creed, Aventus.
Old favourite.
Bobby, we love a t-shirt on this show. Can we make you a bespoke t-shirt, which is, has your dad seen that?
Of course, yeah.
We'll get something mocked up and sent over to you, and we can put some money into a charity of your choice. I bet you that goes like hotcakes. You very sweetly, you did some prep. Is there anything on the whiteboard that we haven't covered off? I love the fact you've actually done some prep for this. Anything we haven't discussed that you need to? Look at that. He's got dates, he's got topics.
It doesn't just happen, boys.
Amazing. Bobby, you're a ledge. We are so grateful to you for coming on. I know the boys are really touched to have had you. You run to the loo. Love and hugs. Good luck this summer. You're the secret ingredient. We hope it comes good. Go forth and conquer. Thanks, pal.
Thank you.
Cheers, Bobby.
Ladies and gents, that was Bobby Boucher. He just makes the world feel a better place, doesn't he?
Well, I think we obviously talk about him a lot on this show. Some people won't have a clue who he is. No, and they'll understand why he has the love of a lot of rather large gentlemen around four nations. So, he's just great crack. I randomly bumped into him on a plane on the way back. It was on the way back from my 40th, actually. I was in the south of France, and he happened to turn up on a plane, and he was sat at the back. And anyway, he managed to convince the stewardess to swap seats with him or something. So he came and sat at the front with us on the stewardess seat. And obviously my birthday was still continuing. He only drinks vodka sodas. And literally,
I didn't find stewardess the end on Apple Music.
Calling S stewardess.
Just imagine that. Literally just spent an hour and a half just chewing the fat with him. And he's brilliant. Walked off the plane a little bit melted, but he's just a top boy. He's generally interested in everyone he works with. So, yeah.
We've had some ledges. We've had some ledges on this show, but I don't think we've had anyone on for whom the two of you have shown so much affection and just warmth and love, Hoff. I mean, he's an absolute character.
Yeah. Look, he's brilliant, Bobby. And, you know, as I said, everyone knows who he is. And, you know, he is a professional. And, you know, to organise that tour and to actually do the balancing act, he has to do, you know, to be the emotional energy all the time. I don't know how he does it. A lot of caffeine, a lot of Red Bull. I know that for a fact. We used to have these caffeine chewing gums. He'd have about seven of them in his mouth all the time. And I think, yeah, but he's brilliant because he's not one of these comedians who's like a sad clown behind closed doors. He's always energy, affectionately loved. And it's great to see someone like that in squads and environments because, you know, like you saw with England, you know, they had him in, and for one coach, he wasn't perceived as the he was surplus to requirements because they felt that he wasn't professional, you know, or perceived as that when that was never the case. Because, and it's just sometimes people are frightened about characters and can't really adjust to someone being super professional, brilliant at what he does as a job, but also fun. That you apparently, if you're in a serious job, you've got to be serious all the time. You can't be both.
I mean, that's the key thing is if you have the back of every single professional player that you've come into contact with, and you have the likes of the glowing reviews of the one that Hass read out from Bod and whoever else, you know that he gets the job done and he does it in the right way. You never get the backing of players if you're not doing a good job, no matter how funny you are. You can be funny and useless and you won't last long. To last that long and do four Lions tours and be funny, you know he does the work behind it. Otherwise, you just wouldn't survive.
12 trophies and counting. That's a stable and a half, that, isn't it? That tells you all you need to know. What a boy. What a pleasure to have him on. And as we said, good luck. Go forth and conquer, Bobby. Let's have a Lions series win for you for this summer as well. That's us done. Before we go, a quick reminder, as always, you can purchase the newest range of GBNR merch together with the England kit manufacturer Umbro. We have got Don't Hassle the Hoff, The Lord's Work, Loose Rhino on behalf of Ellis, The Button Netter, who is Ben. Actually, I enjoyed your Lions selection this week with him, Ben, as well. Tins. Yeah, got some sense, doesn't he?
He does talk some. I can't believe he managed to talk me out of a few of the back selections whilst bullying me in the forward selection. Yeah. But there you go.
Yeah, he's doing a good job. No Pain and No Gain is also available if you like that sort of thing, and we're going to get one mocked up for. Has your dad seen that? Which I think could well
that
go
would
in
be
as
brilliant.
the number one Christmas seller.
There's going to be a big picture of a rope on that t-shirt, yeah. Isn't there, around the words?
Don't rub the rope. if you know, you know. Head to umbro.co.uk/goodbadandrugby to find the selection if you fancy a nibble at that. That is it for Good, Bad and Rugby this week. Well on Hoff, well on Tins. Really good to get Bobby on. The legend that is Mr. Paul Strigeon. As we say, good luck this summer with the Lions. Don't forget about our sister show, which is The Good, the Scouts and the Rugby, together with our friends at Allianz. That's with Emily Scarrett and Elma Smith. And this week, the WBA Bantamweight Champion of the World, Shannon Courtenay, was on. It's a really interesting listen, that one. And you can get that from wherever it is you do your podcasting or your YouTubing. There's also our weekly predictor show. That's on YouTube and Facebook. If you want to go and have a dibble in that, please play nicely. Thank you for listening. Thank you for watching. We'll be back next week with more on the Lions. We've got another little selector show bubbling, which I think could be quite interesting and quite hot topic. See you in 7 days' time for that. For now, enjoy your weeks. All yours, Rob Brydon. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for listening to The Good, The Bad and The Rugby. It can't have been easy.